be able to share it with you, and it hasn't worked out the way I had hoped, and so I apologize for that. It's just not as good as a tool as I was hoping it would be. So I had told you that I created this spreadsheet that tries to chart the events in human history in the Bible. So we talked about the beginning of man's history last time, and today this will be the last time, I promise you, that I use this wretched spreadsheet to try to teach you something. I do encourage you to go to my website to download it if you have a chance to use it on your own computer. It'll be a helpful tool for you. It helps you understand the relationship between things. What happened when? Pardon? Not yet. So today I want to try to use the spreadsheet to teach some important lessons from history. Let's talk first about the lifespan of the patriarchs. The Bible tells us this is the flood year. This is 2331?
Yeah.
2331 BC is what I calculate to be the flood year, but I don't really believe that, and I'll show you why. So Methuselah died in the flood year. This is Methuselah's timeline. And you can see that in the flood year, he was 969 years old, and then he died. He died in the flood year, before the flood. If you had ever heard Gerald Waterhouse, the itinerant evangelist, talk about the flood, he told you that Methuselah's name means his death brings it. And when Methuselah died, the flood came. So Noah was 600 years old when the flood waters covered the earth. You can see Noah's timeline, and in the flood year, Noah is 600. Shem, the Bible says, was 100 years old 2 years after the flood. Now, you need to know that because it doesn't tell you. Usually it'll tell you, it says Adam lived 130 years and he begot Seth, but it doesn't tell you that for Shem. So if Shem was 100 years old 2 years after the flood, then you have to, here's Shem's timeline, you have to come up here to find when Shem was born. So you go back to Shem's timeline is 0. And Noah, you see, was 502 when Shem was born. And that's the only way you can find the date for Shem's birth, because it doesn't tell you Noah was 502, and then he begot Shem. So if you continue with Shem, it says that Shem was 100 years old, and then he begot Arphaxad. So if we go back over here to Shem, and we go down to Shem's age, 102, then his son was born, Arphaxad, and so on and so forth. So if you're if you're using the Bible to construct a genealogy, you're making the assumption that the genealogies are complete and there is no gap in the genealogies, and that Selah was Arphaxad's son and not his great-great-grandson. As I said, I've gone both ways on this. If the genealogies are complete, then we're past 6,000 years. According to that, the end of 6,000 years occurred in 2331 14. So we don't set dates, and we don't try to predict when things are going to happen. It's just interesting to know that we may be somewhere close to the end of 6,000 years. What does that mean? Does God have a 7,000-year plan? It doesn't explicitly say so in the Bible anywhere, but there are indications that God might have a 7,000-year plan for man, but I'm not preaching that you should believe that. Now, some interesting, when you do a genealogy, or when you do a chart like this, you come up with some interesting information. For instance, the lifespans of the patriarchs. I've listed them here. Adam lived 130 years, and then he begot Seth, and Seth lived 105 years, and he begot Enos, and so on and so forth. So you can see, it's interesting to see the age of the firstborn, the age of the man when his first child was born. So the blue lines indicate the age of each man when he had his first son. I apologize. I don't know what's going on with this thing. This doesn't want to stay where it belongs. Okay, now you can see the blue lines. The blue line, here's the age of the patriarch at his death, and this information is all taken out of the Bible, and here is the age of the patriarch when his first son was born. So you can see that it's less than 200 years. It's between 90 and 200 years all these guys had their first male son, or male offspring. But look at Noah. It says that Noah was 502 when Seth was begotten, right? Well, that's an anomaly. All these other guys, they're having children when they're less 100, or you know, around 100 years old. But Seth was born when Noah was 500 years old. All right, so that's one interesting thing. Noah's sort of advanced age when Shem was born, and yet we have always assumed that Shem was Noah's firstborn. But if that's true, then Noah is a really strange anomaly, because look how old he was when Shem was born. Well, the other thing you see from this chart, and I'm sure you know this and everyone understands, that the lifespans of the patriarchs before the flood were about 900 years. Methuselah lived longer than anybody else, and he was 969 years old when he died. However, after the flood, we see lifespans drastically reduced. And we see that the age of the patriarch when his first child was born is much lower. So something happened after the flood. Men didn't live as long. Now, one anomaly to that pattern is Eber. Eber lived to be 469 years old. That was a remarkably long life, because after the flood, lifespans became markedly shortened. God made a pronouncement just before the flood in Genesis 6 and verse 3. The Lord said, "My spirit shall not always strive with man, for he indeed is flesh, and yet his days shall be 120 years. So, we find that lifespans are decreasing after the flood, and yet Noah is some kind of an anomaly, because he was 502 years old when Shem was born. The average age of the patriarch was 104 years when his first son was born before the flood. And Noah is an anomaly. Noah, he wasn't 104, he was 502. So this seems unusual. Now, I guess there are two possibilities, and all we can do is try to figure out which possibility seems more likely. Either Noah, contrary to everybody else who's recorded in the Bible, Noah waited 500 years before he had children, or Noah had younger children who didn't get a seat on the ark. It could be that Noah had older than Shem, but they died not getting a berth on the ark. They died before the flood. So let's talk a little bit about the flood. By my reckoning, the flood occurred The flood occurred 1,657 years after Adam's creation. So let's go back to the timeline. There's the flood in the year 1657, 1,650 years after the birth, or after the creation of Adam. Now let's go down to the time of Abraham. You can see how I'm still following. The green stripe is the critical path. It tells you this man lived so many years and he had a son. Then you've got to jump over here and you keep getting the biblical information about how old this guy was when he had his son and so on and so forth. And I want to get to Abraham. Now here's Abraham. I figure Abraham is born in 1979 BC. That's my best figuring. Now, I'm not saying this is correct. I simply sat down with the Bible one night and started charting this out, and this is what I came up with. So Abraham is born in 1979 BC. This is 352 years after the flood. So the flood wiped out everyone and everything on earth. There were only eight people remaining, and they were saved from the flood by the ark, but they had to repopulate the world. Now, in the time of Abraham, we see nations, we see the earth repopulated with animals. There are nations, there are kingdoms, there are city-states. It seems unlikely to me that the entire earth could have been repopulated to the extent that it was in Abraham's time if only 352 years had elapsed. Does that make sense? My question is, how did the entire earth become repopulated to the point where you had nations and city-states and tribes and peoples that we see on the earth at the time of Abraham? Egypt is a great nation. Abraham has an encounter with Pharaoh. Abraham has an encounter with Abimelech. Abimelech seems to be another dynastic title like Pharaoh. So I see a problem with the genealogies in that only, according to the genealogies, only 352 years elapsed between the flood and Abraham's time. So that leads me to believe that maybe the genealogies have been compressed. That is for what that's worth. So by the time of Abraham, the earth seems to be completely repopulated. But so I don't have a lot of confidence in the dates for the timeline until the birth of Abraham. Now we can work back to the birth of Abraham. Let's go to there it is. Let's go to the fall of Judah. Here is a list of the kings of Israel and Babylon, the kings of Judah. The fall of Judah is a fixed date. We know this. This is a historical date, 586 BC. Judah fell. Judah was conquered by Nebuchadnezzar, by Babylon. They were all taken away into captivity. So we have a list of kings of Israel and of Judah, and knowing 586 BC and knowing the duration of all the reigns of the kings of Judah and Israel, we can work our way back. Here you can see the list of the kings. Now, there are no Israel kings here. I've got the Babylonian kings in this column because 130 years before Judah was taken away into captivity, Israel was taken into captivity. But here we can see the list of the kings, a list of the prophets that prophesied to Judah, and a list of prophets who prophesied to Israel. You don't see any here because Israel's long gone by this time. Let's just scroll up until we get to a king in Israel. Okay, here's the last king of Israel, Hosea. This is 722 BC. Samaria, the northern kingdom, was taken into captivity by Assyria. So if you work your way back through the list of the kings, and I didn't do this work on the kings of Israel, I took this from a publication by UCG. They had a list of the kings, the years that they reigned. It's very difficult because there were periods of co-regency. So we get to Solomon. You remember the kings of Israel were first Saul and then David. As Saul's dynasty collapsed, God took the kingdom away from Saul, gave it to David. David's son Solomon was king for 40 years. So we know that in this year, David and Solomon both reigned. So this is the first year of Solomon's reign. We know David reigned 40 years, and we know that Saul reigned 40 years before David. And so we can get a date for the united monarchy of something like 1052 BC. So just you might write this down in the notes of your Bible, in the margins of your Bible. I figure Saul began reigning around 1052 BC. His reign lasted 40 years. And then David succeeded him, and David's reign was also 40 years. And then he was succeeded by his son Solomon. Now, this gives us a way to get back to some kind of a chronology. Now, 1 Kings chapter 6 and verse 1 can get us from the reign of Solomon back to the Exodus. So we can, having some kind of confidence in the dates that we have here, we can get back to the Exodus, because 1 Kings 6, 1 says, it came to pass in the 480th year, so remember that number, 480, after the 480th year that the children of Israel had come out of the land of Egypt, in the fourth year of Solomon's reign, he began to build in the second month, he began to build the house of the Lord. So, in the fourth year of Solomon's reign, which was 480 years after the Exodus, Solomon began to build the temple. So, 1, 2, 3, 4. There's the fourth year of his reign. This is when Solomon began to build the temple, and we know that this was 480 years before the Exodus, or after the Exodus. So now if we work up here 480 years, we can fix a date for the Exodus, which is what I did. This is the period of the judges, about 400 years of judges. Many periods when Israel obeyed God, didn't obey God. They were conquered by their enemies. They had periods of testing of 40 years, of 80 years. And then finally, Saul was made king over Israel and David succeeded him. So if you go there you go. That's 480 years from the fourth year of Solomon's reign when he began to build the temple. That takes you back to 1449 BC. Many sources agree that that's a good year for the Exodus and for the fall of Jericho, 1449 BC. Now, we know that from Exodus 12 and we know that it was predicted that in Genesis that Abraham's seed would dwell in a land that wasn't theirs for 400 years. And it actually worked out to be 430 years. And some think that that was because it took Abraham 30 years before he ratified the covenant that God was going to make with him. So it says in Exodus 12 that it was exactly 430 years to the selfsame day, it says, that Israel came out of Egypt. So we figured that this is the date of the Exodus, and it says that 430 years before that, Abraham made his covenant with God. So we come up here, 430 years. And this gives us the 430 years, the beginning of the 430 years. This was, I figure it's 430 years beginning with the birth of Isaac. And we know that Abraham was 100 years old when Isaac was born, and so we can go back. This is the birth of Isaac. We can go back 100 years, and from that we can deduce the birth date for Abraham, which I figure is 1979 BC. So that's where I begin to have confidence in the dates on this chart. Before Abraham, I'm not so sure, because I just don't know how God intended us to use those genealogies. And because there are some problems with the earth becoming repopulated with people and with livestock in the 300 and so years that it was between the flood and the birth of Abraham. So Exodus 12, verse 41 says, it came to pass at the end of 430 years, on the very same day it came to pass, the armies of the Lord went out from the land of Egypt. Now, we talked about Noah a little while ago. I want to get back to Noah. I want to talk about the flood a little bit and the ark. And we talked about Noah and the fact that it's possible that he had children older than Shem that didn't get a seat, didn't get a berth on the ark. But let's talk about the experience of being on the ark. And we think, well, they were safe and sound. God had promised them that they would be saved. They knew a flood was coming, but God was going to save them. But let's think a little bit about the experience that they had being on the ark. They survived while millions or billions of people across the earth died. And I'm sure, you have a certain number of friends. I'm 70, and I've made the acquaintance of hundreds or thousands of people in my life. Imagine you had lived for 600 years as Noah had when the flood came. How many friends would you have? How many acquaintances would you have? Noah and his wife and their children lost friends and acquaintances. And I believe that it's possible that Noah even lost family members. It's hard to think that Noah would have gone for 500 years without having any children when everybody else was having children at about the 100-year mark. It's difficult for me to believe that Shem was Noah's first son. I think that he very well could have had other sons and daughters in the 400 years before the birth of Shem. So I think that like Lot, Noah lost family members in the time of God's judgment. And I think that the flood could have been a time of personal sorrow and personal loss for Noah and his family. Try to imagine how it was to be in the ark. Think about you're in the ark, you're closed up, you got your wife with you, your three sons, their daughters. The waters, you've been telling people for a long, long time, for many decades, that God's judgment was coming on the earth, but they didn't believe you. And you're building a ship hundreds of miles from any ocean, a huge ship. It was probably 500 feet long. It was 30 cubits high, so that's about 80 feet. And it was a huge, huge vessel. Well, imagine what it would have been like to be in the ark when the water was 3 feet deep and rising. People know something's wrong now. The ark would have been encircled by hundreds of thousands of people that probably too late began to believe what Noah had been telling them. And they would be demanding to be let in. They'd be pounding on the sides of the ark. And you're inside the ark and you can hear this. And you know people are out there and they're going to die. All kinds of people, elderly people, young people. When the water was 5 feet deep, the ark's not yet floating. The ark's 80 feet tall. It's going to take more than 5 feet of water to float it. Mothers are outside shrieking for the salvation for their babies. Strong men are pounding on the ark and yelling. They're pounding with tree limbs and with rocks. They're hurling threats and insults at Noah and his family. When the water was 6 feet deep, Noah and his family can hear piteous crying outside the ark. They can hear fingernails clawing on the pitch and the timbers of the hull, trying to find purchase, something to hang on to in the pitch-covered boards. They can hear all this. They're inside the ark listening to this, helpless to do anything about it. When the water was 10 feet deep, the cries for help have diminished. The pounding and the clawing sounds are weaker and not as demanding, not as frequent. After a number of days, when the water is 20, 30, 40, 100 feet deep and currents are raging, the waters have finally floated the ark off its support. The only noises outside the ark now are the crashing of waves, howling wind, rain, pelting furiously against the hull. Perhaps the ark is tossed in the air by huge waves. There are no land masses to break up the waves. I think that waves could travel all the way around the earth without being stopped by anything. The waves are growing. The timbers of the ark creak and groan. And Noah's hoping that he pegged everything together solidly and there aren't any joints that are loose. The ark is pitching up and down in the waves. Noah might have built a wooden structure on the front that kept the ark pointed in the direction of the wind. That was very important. I learned that when I was when I bought a kayak. Years ago, I was in Ocean City, and I had a snorkel and mask and fins, and I saw dolphins way out on the water, farther away than the edge of the parking lot over there. So I swam out to try to be near the dolphins, and a guy approached me in a kayak, And he could go out farther. I was afraid to go out any farther. It was just too far out at sea. And this guy came by me in a kayak, and the dolphins were a little farther out. And he said, "I bought this specifically so I could sail around with dolphins." And he went out maybe 50, 100 yards farther than I was. And he came back to me and he said, I paid $800 for this kayak, and it just paid for itself. He said, "I just had the most remarkable experience with dolphins swimming past me and under me." And he said, "It was just marvelous. It was worth every penny I paid for this kayak." Well, so I bought a kayak. And the next year, I was out there with the dolphins. Well, the thing about a kayak is that you've got to get it into shore. And there are waves. So there's a little bit of surf. You know, there are waves that are about this high. And I quickly found out that if you don't... Does anyone know what the term normal to means? When you're talking about like, let's talk about the wave and the kayak. If the wave is going in this direction, the kayak has to be normal to the wave. That's 90 degrees. All right, that's normal to the wave. If you're coming in normal to the wave, your kayak is exactly 90 degrees oriented toward the wave, you get the best ride that you've ever had. I guess it's like being on a surfboard. I've never surfed, but I've done a lot of matting, coming in on waves on a surf mat, and it's great fun. But it was the greatest ride I ever had was on this kayak. You could paddle really fast and catch the wave, and boy, it would just, you'd get right up on the top of the wave and it would take you all the way to shore. There was a problem if your kayak wasn't normal to the wave. If you were a little bit like this, the wave would move the stern of your kayak around so that you're now parallel to the wave. Not normal to it anymore, but parallel. And then it would roll you. So when the ark might have had a device up in the front, sort of like a wooden sail or a wooden keel that was catching the wind. You know how a weather vane works? It'll all point in the direction of the wind. Well, that's what you wanted the ark to do, because you didn't want the ark to be parallel to the waves. You wanted it to be riding into the waves. So there's speculation that, although it's not in the specs that God gave Noah, he might have had a large rectangular wooden structure up on the prow, on the front of the ark, to keep it oriented into the wind so that it's always meeting the waves head on and so that the waves can't roll it. Well, I think that Noah and his family might have had a really exciting ride. The ark might have been negotiating these waves, but it might have been going up and down. Anybody been seasick? I was at the feast several years ago. I was out on a charter boat in the Gulf, and it was very, very rough. And I went, found a point in the center of the boat, because I figured in the center of the boat, that's where you're moving the least. And I would have been okay. But one of the other guys in the charter, another guy from the feast site, got really seasick. And he was in the bathroom for about half an hour, 45 minutes, throwing up. And after I listened to him for that extended period of time, I finally lost it, and I had to go outside and set up a chum line. But I think that the ride on the ark was probably, at times, a very rough ride. So I think that Noah and his family might have been racked with seasickness for many days. They'd never been on a boat before that was going to go on a ride like this. Might have been days before they could take nourishment. So they're wondering if this craft they have built can withstand the stress of the raging cataclysm that's engulfed the world. But God designed the ark perfectly. Modern ship designers assert that the dimensions of the ark, as God designed it and gave the plans to Noah, are perfect for optimizing three things: strength and comfort
and stability in heavy seas. So the ark was built to the same proportions as a modern ship would have been. And it probably had a pointed prow. You see many reconstructions and artist conceptions of what the ark looked like, and it was just like a brick, right? Just a rectangle. But the specifications didn't demand a brick-like shape. It could have had a tapered prow like a modern ship, and it was built to be able to weather and negotiate waves of 100 feet in height. Well, we all have faith in God to one extent or another. But these people were on a terrifying ride. For days and weeks, they were forced to cope with a horrendous tempest that tossed their craft like a leaf in the wind. That I believe they might have lived with terror and fear and uncertainty and anxiety for an extended period of time. It might have been a terribly rough ride. They can hear the death throes of humanity all around them. Perhaps they began to wish that their lives could have ended rather than to be exposed to the continuing horror of the near extinction of all humanity. I believe it very well could have been one of the most harrowing experiences to which humans have ever been exposed. I think we err if we don't consider the stress, the terror, the trauma, the horror to which Noah and his family were subjected. In the Bible, of course, we've got the book of Psalms, and the book of Psalms is five separate books. Each has a different theme. And the third book of the Psalms encompasses Psalm 73 to 79, or to 89. And these Psalms are about the Great Tribulation. If you want to have an interesting Bible study, get out your Bible and read Psalms 73 to 89. And if you are reading this and thinking about the context of the Great Tribulation, prophecy flies right off the page. It's unmistakable to recognize it. Many of these Psalms describe the feelings of God's people who are being protected from death by God, and yet they're suffering terrible anxiety. Let's look at Psalm 77, starting in verse 4. Psalm 77, verse 4, you hold my eyelids open. I don't want to open my eyes, but God is holding them open, it says. I am so troubled, I cannot speak. And yet, in the midst of all this, the terrible things that are happening, he has to cling to something that will give him stability. I have considered the days of old, the years of ancient times. I call to remembrance my song in the night. I meditate within my heart, and my spirit makes diligent search. And this is what he's thinking. This is what this individual, this is his response to the terror, the death, the horror, the violence of the Great Tribulation. He thinks, he wonders, will the Lord cast off forever? Will he be favorable no more? This is what God's people are thinking in the Great Tribulation. Things are so bad, they're wondering if God is really still involved with their lives. Have you ever felt like that when you're in a trial? Is God really with me? Will God really save me from this trial? This is the greatest trial that's ever befallen humankind. And this psalm indicates the thoughts of God's people during horrible calamity from which they're being saved and yet from which they are not completely insulated. You hold my eyelids open. Noah and his family must have been thinking thoughts such as these during the great flood. Now, you're probably familiar with a song Gordon Lightfoot wrote. It was about an ore freighter that used to ply the Great Lakes from bringing ore from Minnesota to smelting plants in Detroit. The ship was called the Edmund Fitzgerald. It had gone into service in 1955, and it was capable of carrying 36,000 tons of iron ore. In November 1975, in Lake Superior, the Edmund Fitzgerald was being tracked in a storm. It disappeared from radar, just disappeared, vanished. The hull was found crushed and broken up on the bottom of Lake Superior. It was trying to make its way through hurricane-force winds and 35-foot waves. And in trying to imagine the ordeal of the crew in trying to manage the ship and the horrible waves, Gordon Lightfoot, who wrote a song called "The Wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald," wrote a line in his lyric that's always haunted me. And I think it describes what the guy in the psalm that we just read and what Noah and his family may have been thinking. He wrote, "Does anyone know where the love of God goes when the waves turn the minutes to hours?" The men on the Edmund Fitzgerald must have been thinking that they had been completely forsaken by God, and they were in a ship that was being torn apart by wind and wave. Does anyone know where the love of God goes when the waves turn the minutes to hours? It was just a matter of hours that the crew had to endure this storm before their ship was sunk. But think of the time that Noah and his family must have endured some of the same kinds of anxiety and fear and wondering if God was still with them. In times of enormous stress, God's people can feel as if God has abandoned them or has abandoned his love and mercy. I don't think that Noah and his family just had terrific faith and all they did was find a comfortable spot and something to hold on to and just wait patiently for this trial to end. I think it was a terrible trial for them. They experienced fear and grief and worry and a sense of loss for friends and family, I believe. Sympathy for the dead, remorse, perhaps even survivor's guilt. Being on the ark was not just a brief, if somewhat convenient, carnival cruise. It was a grueling trial. There must have been times when they wondered where the love of God had gone. The Psalms record and predict the way God's people react in times of severe trial, even if they're being protected. In verse 8 of the Psalm, "Has his mercy ceased forever? Has his promise failed forevermore? Has God forgotten to be gracious? Has he in anger shut up his tender mercy?" That's just about the same thing that Gordon Lightfoot said, isn't it? This psalm is about God's people who are enduring the great tribulation. They may be in a place of safety, but the world around them is being torn apart, torn to shreds, and billions are dying. And God's people are in anguish. Verse 10, "And I said, this is my anguish." But in their anguish, they remember the works of God. That's their anchor. They remember his promise of steadfast love. He continues, "But I will remember the years of the right hand of the Most High. I will remember the works of the Lord. Surely I will remember your wonders of old. I will also meditate on all your work and talk of your deeds. Your way, O God, is in the sanctuary. What is so great? Who is so great a God as our God?" So Noah and his family were in a place of safety, but they had a front row seat to experience the destruction of humanity and everything that was familiar to them. I think their trip on the ark was a trip filled with anguish and horror. And Noah and his family were traumatized by the experience of the flood. They lost family members, they lost friends, they lost every institution they had known. They lost their home. Nothing was recognizable after the flood. The landscape was strewn with corpses of people, millions of them, and dead animals. And I believe that these experiences traumatized Noah and his family. And I think that having lost friends, perhaps having lost family, I think this is what This is why Noah took to drink. In Genesis 9, verse 20, we learn, after the flood, Noah began to be a farmer, and he planted a vineyard, and he drank of the wine and was drunk and became uncovered in his tent. Noah was a righteous man. That's why he was saved. Noah wasn't a drunkard before the flood. It was the experiences of the flood that drove him to drink. Remember, righteous Lot. Lot is another righteous man. Righteous Lot had a similar experience, and he tried to hide from his emotions in drink. Turn to Genesis 19, verse 33. Remember, he's referred to as righteous Lot, who was vexed with the iniquity of the... how does it say that? He was vexed by the sins of the people among whom he lived. But in Genesis 19, 35, it says, "So they, his daughters, made their father to drink wine that night, and the firstborn went in and lay with her father, and he didn't know when she lay down or when she arose. And the same thing happened the second night." Here's a righteous man who has somehow taken to drink and gets passed out drunk and doesn't even know what he's doing. Although his daughters encouraged him to drink, a righteous man does not get passing out drunk without cause. There's no prior mention of Lot being a drunkard. He was righteous. He was one of the righteous that God had promised Abraham to save. Now, when the angels dragged Lot and his wife and his two daughters out of their house, they said to him, "You got to come with us now, you and your children who are here," indicating that there were other children who weren't there. So Lot lost family members in the great fires that consumed Sodom. His drunkenness, I believe, was a result of the trauma he had experienced. He and his daughters thought that the entire world and all humankind had been nuked. Genesis 19:31, the firstborn said to the younger, "Our father is old, and there is no man on earth to come into us as the custom of all the earth." They thought they were the last survivors, the only living remnant of humanity on the earth, because the destruction apparently was all around them, and all they could see was the cities that were completely torched, completely nuked. I believe that both Noah and Lot were suffering from extreme post-traumatic stress disorder, like shell-shocked soldiers. Even when they're protected by God's people suffer trauma and anguish as they witness God's wrath being poured out on rebellious and disobedient humanity. So if we live into the great tribulation of the day of the Lord, we will suffer trauma and anguish like that of Noah and Lot. Whether we're in a place of safety or not, we won't be insulated completely from what is happening around us. So if we plan to live on into the great tribulation, we need to be prepared for that. And one thing we've got to hang on to an anchor, like an anchor, is to remember the faithfulness and the mercy of our God. Now, getting back to the ark. The ark was a means of salvation for 8 human beings and a large collection of animals. To miss getting on the ark was to lose salvation. The ark is a metaphor for salvation. Now, you remember in the specifications, I won't turn there, but God told Noah to build one door into the side of the ark. So the ark contained one door. It had two functions. It allowed access for those who were going to be granted salvation, and it prevented everybody else from entering. The other people who wanted to get on the ark would have been a threat to Noah and his family, and they were not chosen for salvation, so they didn't go through the door on the ark. Now, in the book of John, Jesus describes himself as many things. I'll let you look up the scriptures yourself, but he said, "I'm the bread of life, I'm the light of the world, I'm the good shepherd, I'm the resurrection and the life. I'm a teacher. I'm the way, the truth, and the life. I am the true vine." And in John 10 and verse 9, Jesus said, "I am the door. If anyone enters by me, he will be saved and go in and go out and find pasture. Just like those who were able to go in through the door on the ark, Jesus describes himself as the door. He's the door to salvation. Just as the door on the ark was the door to salvation for Noah and his wife and his three sons and their wives, it's necessary to go through the door in order to achieve salvation. Jesus is the only door. There is no other door to salvation. Let's look at Acts 4 and verse 11. Acts 4, verse 11. This is the stone which was rejected by you builders, which has become the chief cornerstone. Nor is there salvation in any other, for there is no other name under heaven given among men by which we must be saved. So the ark was the only means of salvation in the time of the flood, and Jesus is the only means, the only door to salvation now, and Jesus' name, the name Jesus, means God saves. The righteous will gain access to the door, but evildoers will be shut out. Just as the door on the ark was the only portal to salvation, Jesus is the only portal or door for salvation in this age. Now, Jesus, we hear people say, well, I believe in Jesus, but was there really an Adam, and was there really a flood, and was there really an ark? Seems hard to believe. Well, if you believe Jesus, Jesus believed in the flood. Jesus talked about the flood as a historical event and drew lessons from it. Jesus said that just as the flood was unanticipated by the people who lived on the earth at that time, humankind will be completely oblivious to the impending wrath of God at the end of the age. In Matthew 24, he says, at the Mount Olivet prophecy, Matthew 24, verse 36, but of the day and hour no one knows, not even the angels of heaven, but my Father only. But as in the days of Noah were, so also will the coming of the Son of Man be. For as in the days before the flood, they were eating, drinking, marrying, and giving in marriage, just going on through daily life as if it's always going to be that way, until the day Noah entered the ark and did not know until the flood came and took them all away, so also will be the coming of the Son of Man. So Jesus tells us to watch and be ready. Watch what? Watch world events. That's what you hear. We need to be tuned into world events so that you know when the end of the age is coming, I guess, or so you know how prophecy is being fulfilled. I spoke on the topic at length. I gave a whole sermon about it several years ago. What Jesus wants us to do is watch our own spiritual condition to be sure that we're not letting down, to be sure that we're not following the world, to be sure that we're not falling back into bad habits that characterize the people of the world. In Luke 21, he says, this is a follow-on to the scripture in Matthew 24 that we read a minute ago. Luke 21 adds a bit that Matthew didn't. Jesus said, take heed to, in other words, watch yourselves. So Jesus told us to watch and be ready, but he's not telling us to watch world conditions. He's telling us, and there's nothing wrong with that, but what Jesus is interested in is that we watch ourselves. Luke 21:34, take heed to yourselves, lest your hearts be weighed down with carousing, drunkenness, and the cares of this life. There are plenty of cares in this life. I know that several of us are retired now, and so we don't have the same schedule. Mr. Duck is laughing. Maybe he does. Are you still not retired? Are you still unretired? Still working?
Retired.
Oh, way to go. Way to go. But getting up at 4:30 so you have time to prepare yourself for the day and get to work. For me, it's been up to an hour and a half drive to work sometimes. The cares of this world at work. Work is grueling, crushing, fraught with anxiety and concern and hoping that things turn out right and that you didn't do something wrong. the cares of this world weigh our hearts down, and the day come on you unexpectedly. So what he's saying is if we're not watching ourselves, we're getting so caught up in the world, the day, the great tribulation and all those terrible events would come on us unexpectedly. For it will come as a snare on all those who dwell on the face of the earth. Watch, therefore. Watch yourself, he's saying. Take heed to yourselves. Watch, therefore, and pray always that you may be counted worthy to escape all these things that will come to pass and to stand before the Son of Man. So, Jesus describes the people of our age as being just like the people who perished in the flood. Obviously, Jesus believed in the flood. He taught the flood story. He confirmed all that the Genesis account says about it. The flood did engulf the entire earth. And we who are alive today need to learn and apply the lessons of the flood. So on rare occasions, God's judgment has descended on the earth. And there's one more period of God's judgment predicted, and that's the Great Tribulation. It will be a miserable and terrifying time, even for those who are being saved from it. And Christians must watch and pray that we will be worthy to escape.